This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
We back.
The yak. Hip-hop grew up.
Man.
I'm ready.
We got so much stuff to talk about.
Mm-hmm. I'm ready. Talk to me.
First, I gotta give a shout out to my good friend Chameleonaire and, long time work associate. Actually, my boss. He hired me. Or my client, depending on how you look at it. But
I'll bring you right back there.
Mm-hmm, go.
But all the listeners and our family and our friends and our kids and everybody that's listening, thank you for coming back.
Hey.
Thank you for coming back.
Thank you for
coming back. Hip-hop grew up, Rapid Rick, Bavu Blakes, and we do have to give a heartfelt shout out that pulls really all that together to Chameleonaire.
Yeah. Thank you for letting me. I DJed for him for like 10 years and still on occasion, in case he decides to do a show in overseas or Dubai, he asked me to come DJ for him still. He gave a shout out to my...
Can you repeat that? You tried to slip that in. Say that again. So this is Chameleonaire, who, final episode of Sopranos and Old White Lady's ringtones at the peak of the ringtone era and many other like big time television placements. It's kind of like Power for Kanye West. It's one of those songs that gets so many placements and completely permeates culture. Not a lot of rap songs can do that.
They see me roll.
Not a lot of songs, period.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a classic.
It's a classic
American pop level record, like regardless of genre.
Exactly. And the cool thing about him, he always had the business mind to own a bigger chunk of it than the average artist.
Mm-hmm.
Bigger piece of the pie.
Bigger piece of his mind.
Yeah. So
his brain.
He was always smart on that tip and very smart in acquiring a large internet audience. And so before social media. So before there was even MySpace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Think about what I just said. Before there was even... I'm not even talking about Facebook, which us old people still use to... I'm talking about before even MySpace. He had a large internet following. He had a site with moderators and all this stuff.
I got a story for you.
And then now he owns several companies. Probably like one of them, I know it was like $500 million it sold. What was your story?
I'm going to back it up a little bit.
Go.
First of all, my friend DOS, who runs a pizza company called The Slice.
Love those pizzas.
Yeah, they brought some to Decker not too long ago.
Yeah.
He gave me his email address before people were giving out email addresses, and it was disastro@chameleonaire.com.
That was his email?
Yes.
Everyone was on that website, yep.
Now, another story.
Disastro.
A friend of mine named Ricardo gave me a Paul Wall and Chameleonaire CD, handwritten, on the shiny disc.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was Memorex. Get Your Mind Correct. No, it was Memorex CDR, CDR, I think.
Yes.
And it was Get Your Mind Correct and just said, you need to listen to this. Mm-hmm. So those two people, one of which is you, kind of put that in a frame for me to where I was looking on the website and listening to the music and really getting hip, at a time where, I barely knew them. And next thing you know, we were around them a lot.
Matt was around them a lot, put us in with them.
Paul Wall wrote a verse, memorized it, and knocked out in one take in Dallas for me.
This guy named DJ
Probably
Sense,
my biggest
who
record.
Sold mixtapes on the East Side, knew him and introduced me. And I think Trey the Truth introduced me to it. Like, this is a long time ago, Austin rap scene. But anyway,
you end up all over the world.
Yeah.
And now he's a BC guy.
Yes.
Like Nas, kind of.
So, I was going to send him a text. Or I was going to, send him an Instagram message. I was like, no, let me hit him up on his own app. Convos, right? So I hit him up, and I was like, hey. And it's kind of like a Snapchat, right? But they can kind of see your facial reaction while you make the video, Or you can see theirs. And then, and so So I sent him, I was like, hey, someone, you know, doing Black History Month about you. Maybe you could do shout out to the school and I can ask you like 3 intelligent questions. And he did it and he killed it. And so he didn't have to do that. Out there making millions per second, you know.
Right.
And he took the time out to do that. But I hope, you know, whenever I show this to the students at Decker Middle School, they'll be very, very happy and excited.
Right. So Black History Month started by Carter G. Woodson.
Yes.
He felt that it should not last because Black history should then be embedded in American history.
Really? What was the timeline? How long did he expect
I can't remember exactly. I don't know if he actually said a year, but he was like, basically, hopefully this will be unnecessary soon. And this is just the beginning and people will start, you know, incorporating history, Black history, but it's still sectioned off, you know, of course in the educational sector.
Yeah.
And I think just in mainstream, you know, USA culture, standard culture, I think it's still like a little section, which is crazy.
A month?
It's not even the month part. It's the part that, you know, Black stuff is in a Black category. And there weren't even people, you know, classified as a Black race, right? Until
the 1700s.
1600s, when all this was being set up, it had to speak for the system and help organize and classify the system in a way where people didn't feel so bad, you know, about where these Black people were fitting into society, you know, and into law, and into, you know,
trying to figure out ways where, like, hey, there's all these dark colored people there, but man, they certainly got good land, and what's one way we could how about we just don't even count them as people when we do that? Let's do that.
Let's make up a story where we can say they don't have our brain capacity, similar to, you know, the so-called Indians. Let's classify them as subhuman so that we don't feel so bad, or it seems logical that we can control them in every way. As far as our setup, we're not going to honor them, their perspectives, their stories, their culture, beyond what allows us to control this mud. Yeah.
Colonization.
So, speaking of which, like, we're in a place here, Austin, right?
Yeah.
Barton Springs. Sacred.
Love that place. I love it.
Sacred to the natives prior to Barton moving here.
Yeah. It's kind of when you go there, it kind of feels like you kind of feel the awe, like, this is awesome. This is like nice, clear, drinkable water coming from the center of the earth, and this nice little hilly place with great sunsets.
I believe it was a Tonkawa. I don't know how to say it correct, but that's right. That was all up in there, and spoke about sacred powers of it. So anyway, we were talking about how there's these different categories in the way that race has factored in, and not just, I mean, you could kind of simplify it to color race, really, because it started off pretty primitive, like some white, Black, brown, yellow type thing. And of course there's people now who are imputed as white who weren't then, depending on what part of Europe they were from. So even that has matured a lot.
Yes.
But in the mix of all that, probably the most controversial race, of course, on the land where we sit, and of course on display for the whole United States to see based on who our current president is and commander-in-chief as well, the first major war the U.S. ever fought. What was it?
The first war the U.S. ever fought?
First big war.
Not including the Revolutionary War. I guess it wasn't U.S. back then, but War of 1812.
How big was that war?
It was pretty big. I think they burned down the White House. And then the big battle was obviously the Battle of New Orleans, right? Where Andrew Jackson somehow beat the British. And I think he had some spies and stuff like that. But the British obviously had a much bigger force. But that's it.
War of 1812. All right.
The war that everyone forgets.
I'm on it. So let me look that up for a second.
And by the way, the tribe that you were talking about that lived in Austin, that hung out right there by Barton Springs, the Tonkawa.
There we go. I was saying Tonkawa, right? Mm-hmm. Tonkawa. So, War of 1812. I want to see the body count. Casualties and losses. 2,200 to 3,721 killed. And so I think in all, it looks like British Empire is about 2,000. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the U.S. side. Yep. The U.S. side is about 4,000. Right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So in all, that's roughly what, 6,000?
Yep.
Okay. And now I'm looking up the Mexican-American War. Mexicans. 1,733.
You're looking at the...
Americans. I'm looking at Wikipedia.
No, but which war? The...
This is Mexican-American War.
Okay, but did you skip over the Texas Revolution?
Texas Revolution was not the United States, officially.
You're right.
But, of course, Texas was borrowing money to do it from the United States, and there was a lot of United States... citizens and Europeans who came to get involved as well.
Okay. So you're looking at Mexican-American War then. Casualties, right. What's the number?
It's about 7,000.
On both sides?
No, 5,000 on Mexico side, 1,733 on the United States.
So it's 1,700.
So it's a little little bigger than 1812. But it's still going on. Mm-hmm. In so many ways... That particular conflict just never went away. Mexicans became the other after that point. And on all the land that's in the United States that was Mexico, you can see in a lot of systems, including, I mean, there's a lot of accommodation. There's a lot of Spanish language, of course, that's translated. But we both know that in the education system, there's so much that hasn't been figured out by a population that'll be the biggest in our state and that's been here the whole time. Somehow they're still out of the picture. Yeah. Tom Brokaw, just the other day. You know Tom Brokaw?
Yeah, NBC.
Did you hear what he said the other day?
What did he say?
He said Mexican Americans need to assimilate and learn English. Tom Brokaw, last week.
Like, he tweeted it or something?
No, he said it on the news.
Like... Is he still reporting or is he retired?
He's still reporting.
Wow.
That was his opinion.
Well, I think if you take the DNA of most either Mexican-Americans or most Mexican citizens or just most of the brown-colored people who've been living here for about 100,000 years, you'd find out that their DNA would tell you that they're mostly Native American, right? And I think they've been assimilating ever since people came over here in ships and put flags on the ground, right?
Yep.
And so I think people from this region or Mexico, they're now the U.S., haven't even a third layer of assimilation, right? Because they're Native Americans, right? And I'm pretty sure tribes took over other tribes and they had to assimilate there.
Break it down.
And I think... When these people, the Spaniards came, or the Portuguese, if we're talking about South America, came and, you know, said, this is, hey, look, we found this. And there's some people who are half naked who don't know anything.
Even little French, they had French, German.
Calendars that were amazing and, like, great astronomical and other really cool things. They just kind of, and it's just all about force. It's colonization. You know, who has the bigger gun kind of takes over. And even when I'm looking at the casualties and losses of this Mexican-American War that happened, like, in the 1870s, right? No, 1845.
They annexed Texas, so they inherited that beef. And now, you know, but they basically had to eat the debt.
And it's a strategic move, because at that point, the U.S. is half the size, right?
Right.
And it needed to get California.
Right.
And there's no way in hell you're going to get California without what?
Texas, the seed of manifest destiny. The seed of manifest destiny.
That's a great social studies term. So manifest destiny is the desire to want to head west. And that term,
it's to make seed of shining sea European colony.
Yeah, and it's not even. Yeah, European colony. I would just say
Anglo-European colony. At that time, it was that empire that was trying to go from sea to shining sea. United States of America, absolutely.
But European? And that's not European, though.
England's not in Europe. They're not European. I'm saying
they're European, not a colony anymore.
But it's where they came from. The base was English America.
It's not a colony.
But it's the base. Mm-hmm. It started as a colony. It's, so,
Australia a base?
It's an independent country now. Australia? Australia's a European colony. It's the descendant. Was. Right. At its foundation is what I mean. I don't mean now, but the culture.
And Mexico was a Spanish colony.
Mexico was a Spanish colony. But Mexico then was an independent Spanish colony. And just because Mexico is a different place.
Yes.
There's this thing.
But whether you call it a colony, whether you call it a country, whether you call it whatever.
Mm-hmm.
People came over here on boats, stuck flags on the ground, and brought language, and brought
that
swords, and brought gunpowder,
right.
brought cannons, and blood, and diseases, because, you know, they just came from a whole different part of the world, that and all that stuff hadn't come over here yet, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so when all that happened, the people that live in the Mexico region, like, right, had to assimilate to, oh, shit, all right, okay, we're going to speak Spanish now. Okay, gotcha. And then after that, what happens? So now, Stephen F. Austin's here, and, you know.
That's where Mexico messed up.
These white boys are calling the shots now in this place we call Texas. All right, got you. No problem. They have to assimilate a third time. Or, I mean, a second time.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Second time.
And they're like, all right, well, let's just not speak the Spanish thing anymore, and let me speak this English thing now. So a lot of people really do not understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. You know, for thousands of years, we probably told oral stories, right?
Right.
We didn't write things down. We would gather around, and family was really close.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see remnants of that in our culture today.
Yes.
And then
as much as the United States is a European colony, Mexico at its culture is super family oriented.
Yes.
Yes.
And community oriented. They don't know that, you know. They had to give up everything and start speaking Spanish, and then to give up however they became spiritual to, you know, Catholicism. And now they're going to kind of like let that go to just kind of be more American. And to be more American is actually to let go of the Catholicism, right? You know?
Be Protestant.
Yeah, it's kind of that.
Which goes back to the European part.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But all that's like what remnants of the Middle East anyway. So it's like it all spreads from.
It is, but not in the way it functions.
No, not in the way it functions. You're right.
Yeah, like religion doesn't stay the same over time, you know?
Because it's man-made.
Too. Right, right. So. And it's got the heavy cultural context, and it's used in many ways to kind of program and shape society, of course, which is why the Pope was involved in the whole Western, you know, exploration in the first place. So, and it's funny that that's Catholic, but then the U.S. ends up being Protestant.
Yeah, so people have always been doing mean things to people. And some good things. There's also good, like people have good and have bad, in my opinion. But I think people just treat people different when they look different or they speak different or they talk different. And even when they're just like religion is different. I remember I was talking to you about one time we went to like it was in Eastern Europe, and it was there's Bosnians there, there's Serbians there, and then this was. Kosovo. Kosovo, you know, a lot of people, they just look like, I remember we have a friend that's Bosnian, right?
Yeah.
I have a friend in Toronto, Lola, and she's Serbian. And then these folks were from Kosovo. They're all different ethnic groups within like 100 miles, right? They all, in my opinion, look exactly the same, but they hate each other, you know? Or like, they just, you know, they can't, you know, and that's, it's just like when people are different, they just don't like each other, man.
I think there's systems that cause people to believe in it over time. I don't think you're
to believe in what?
Meaning those are just passed down like superficial traditions at this point. When it goes from generation to generation to generation, you can't act like you're born genuinely caring about it. You're in a system that promotes it, and that's just the way it functions.
Yeah.
Like that background of race, you know, here. It still affects, like, we're still talking about building a wall in the news. We're a long way from the early 1800s.
People are scared.
People are scared.
And I don't know why. And then you're talking about like...
Who's scared?
I don't know. Well, people think they need a wall. So they're scared, or someone's making them scared. Maybe mm-hmm. I should say that. But I do see a lot more illegal immigration than before. Mm-hmm. And this is coming from a dude from the border who's, you know, mm-hmm. my dad was a coyote and used to do that. And he's deported and doesn't live in the United States anymore. Lives in Mexico, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, a lot of people don't know that about me. So I just opened up. But it's definitely way more than it was in the 70s and 80s. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's... The people bringing in folks are highly organized, and I don't think they're using like open borders to get them across either. Like the data shows that most of these people are coming like straight through entry points. Mm-hmm. There's just like a million trucks, and you don't have time to inspect a million trucks, right? Mm-hmm. So those other trucks that don't get caught, like, you know, you hear about all the things that they get caught, but what about the things that don't get pulled over? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things going across, and that's like they got to figure out ways where they control those entry points better, you know, or figure out. I think more research needs to be spent on that because it's going to be difficult, like, to just build a wall without a base or over all that territory. You know, mm-hmm. in the Great Wall of China, you see how I've been there, and you see when they built that, that's kind of like a fort, and they had soldiers, and it was a communication system. Mm-hmm. So they had like fires lit up, and the fires would, hey, the invaders are over here, and that's how they communicated even before Wi-Fi and stuff like that. So they kind of used that. It was a different system back then. It's an awesome scene, but I don't think anyone's trying to go to the southwest border to hang out on a wall, or military people just chill out there on a base like that. It doesn't seem logical. It seems like he's just, you know, the powers that be are just kind of trying to satisfy their masses through, like, social media promises, and I think that's what this is. But people are angry, and they're scared, and it kind of reminds me of, like, Indian removal, you know? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, hey, we want to move over here and have farms, but there's too many of y'all, so can you move over here? And, you know...
Be an inferior race.
Yeah, be an inferior race, but if you just know...
Be invisible.
I think a lot of people have a lot of respect... In America, have a lot of respect for Native Americans. They just understood that, you know, these people who have lived in this region for a long time are from the same descendants, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's been colonized over and over again. And we're just, you know, being mean. They just need to learn English. They need to do all this stuff. It's like, well, hold on, man, because... I think, you know, that's a lot of languages, and then, you know, it's apples and oranges. We got different histories. You have one language that you've always known. They've had, you know, I'm not saying that they had to learn three languages. It's all obviously generational, but it definitely impacts society. You know, the people speaking the dominant language are going to excel. Mm-hmm. So, like,
even though in the world, it's not a dominant language.
Yeah, in the 1600s, 1700s, when these natives were like, oh, okay, we're speaking Spanish, they had to adjust, and it took many, many generations to kind of like, okay, my kid's going to school now, I'm with it. And then, no, it's English now. All right, so let's start this back up another 5-10 generations, and you get with that, you know? Mm-hmm. Just to be on the same level as, you know, a regular Anglo kid going to college and is someone bringing their family up to that level.
Yeah, and it blows my mind. That as long as public education has been in place, there's still such a failure to accommodate students whose home language is Spanish.
Yeah.
That's still a big struggle. Like, it hasn't been there forever.
And education, yeah, they kind of...
Like, that's not the dominant group.
Yeah, and in education, they get the short end of the stick, in my opinion. There's also a lot of people who care and try to help.
Of course.
Including myself,
of course,
trying to just make sure that, because they're kind of like, they're using language in a way to say that these kids ain't smart. There's some genius kids who just speak a different language, man. And so they're right. Like decoding and trying to figure out these words and try to get better at it. And yeah, I think they kind of get graded wrong or kind of.
Yeah, I was at a conference called COSBOC, mm-hmm. Council of schools, coalition of schools educating boys of color.
Yeah.
And the information I was presenting applies to this situation too, even though the focus there, I think, is mostly it's black boys. Uh-huh. But the bottom line is the language and the testing specifically. Yeah. Okay, let me break it. Let me back up a little bit. I'll let you back. When you're in an area where you have linguistic, where you're linguistically marginalized from standard American English, you're usually also culturally marginalized. Geographically, in the case of our campus that we've been working on, geographically marginalized, and then socioeconomically marginalized. So that's four different
ways.
It's
a fancy way of saying it's on the east side.
It's a fancy way, but it's analyzing the different ways that mainstream society doesn't accommodate you because it's different. Geography is one thing. Money's another.
Gotcha.
Language is another.
Yep.
And culture is another.
I never thought of it that way. You're right. There's a whole bunch of...
That's four different ways. Those things work differently, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Four different ways. And so then when you're in that place, it naturally shows through study that... You can ask three questions and figure out what those reading and math scores are going to look like anyway without taking them.
Wow.
Generally. And those three qualifiers are the families in this community making, how many families in this community, excuse me, how many families in this community are making 200 grand or more a year? Question number one. Mm-hmm. Question number two, how many families in this community are in poverty? Question number three, how many families in this community have bachelor's degrees? If you look at those three things, then you can generally predict standardized test data without even taking it to a fairly accurate degree.
Yeah.
So those are the places that get over-tested. And with or without those language gaps, when your home language is not the language of the test, generally speaking, we already know what's coming. And so what happens is there's a psychological damage and trauma just from being there, by being over-tested in those places, because that's seen as a solution to not doing well on your tests. Since the schools, the districts, they're scored A to F based on reading and math tests. That's the reality right now. And I see so much damage that's being done, and education has a huge opportunity to improve in the way that specifically it educates the Mexican-American child.
I agree, man. It took us like about 27 minutes to get that off our chest, but I'm glad we did.
They weren't expecting that.
I had to get it off my chest. I know normally we talk about what hip-hop people are doing, how they're better in the community.
But... Oh, and we will, but that's our conversation. Yeah. And it's like we went HD on them because we are the same guys who were, you know, in the studio trying to perfect our craft.
I still DJ.
Less than 20 years ago. But I mean, as new guys, learning. And now we can have that robust conversation.
Yes, we're going all nerd on y'all.
It grew up.
So speaking about growing up, I want to do... Well, you mentioned this, is having a hip-hop grew up roll call, ATX edition. So these are the people around Austin that you remember in the hip-hop scene, but now they're growing up and doing grown-up things. The first on the list...
I'll give you a name and you tell me what you remember.
Go ahead.
And that'll frame it. And then I'll walk them up on the grew up.
All right, go for it.
DJ Baby G.
DJ Baby G was...
Who's that?
1990 or 1989 DMC World Champion DJ.
U.S. Champion.
U.S. Champion DJ.
Mexican.
Mexican-American from Dallas.
And Korean.
That's right, half Korean. But he looks
national
like a Mexican
champion.
Dude. But national DJ champion in what Austin, you know? In late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of hung out, and then I worked with them at the radio station, Hot 93.3. One of the very first DJs I met that was like professional and organized and made schedules and spreadsheets. Like, you don't run into many of those, and I'm glad I ran into him at an early age. So thank you, Baby G, for being like a mentor, you know, to how to kind of get on the tables and still get your money and not looking like a jackass. So that's what I know about Baby G.
Okay. So
what's he doing?
I'll add some things to that.
Go.
Backstory.
Mm-hmm.
He once signed a record deal with Luke Skywalker.
Damn.
And he also signed a major deal with a group out of Dallas called Mad Flavor and went on a lot of major tours. Like, he was in the game for a minute, like that.
Luke Skywalker, like.
Yes. If you look up a group called 2AUK, number two, AWK. You'll see that that was a duo from Dallas once signed to Loop.
That is dope.
I don't think that group popped off, but Mad Flavor kind of popped off. Like, they had a nice rotation. You know, they were one of those groups that was in the mix and out there.
That is dope.
Through a major. So that was some of his background, too. But, yeah, he did move to Austin. Mm-hmm. 1999, if
hip-hop
I remember.
Legend. And then, like, he would be the dude, like, it'd be like Baby G, just like how big like Mel is, right? Mm-hmm. Mel maintains the DJ name huge.
They did Nasties together on Mondays for a long time.
That was...
And he did Soul Shakedown Reggae Nights because he was part of this reggae crew called Black One Sound System in Dallas as well. So
the reggae nights are crazy. My wife used to go all the time. Ring the Alarm. Remember those two?
Yep. But what makes Baby G, Baby G, as you spoke to earlier, is like his professionalism, his mannerisms. We both have older boys and younger girls and, you know, get together around the family a lot. What's up, G? What's up, Priscilla? But he really knew how to carry himself in such a professional manner to be a mentor, to kind of give you aspirations of how to handle business and be a good person and treat people with respect and not get caught up in the show business, but still be super dope. That's what I looked up to him for, is he felt like a whole person to me. I admired him. I admired him for that reason.
Yes.
And from the moment he came to Austin, Sunday School was something I believe he was doing in Dallas already. And Jay and Shell, I told you about how Hump Day started with these brothers of mine that I was in a group with. Mm-hmm. Well, in addition to dissolving our group into the Hip Hop Hump Day.
Yes.
They're the ones who set up Sunday School for Baby G at the Side Street Bar. So he had a residency after he moved in town.
Nice.
So he graduates from UT. He gets with this really cool young lady from Harvard who was all about him at Plush, and it all works out. And now they have two kids at an elementary school, Becker, where the Quesadas kids go and where I was at the other day at work. But anyway, now he mentors nurses.
He's the nurse guru.
Now he mentors and manages and leads nurses.
Man, you don't
in a major hotel. I mean, it's not hotel, hospital, St. David's system.
I think my last year at UT, like, this was back in early 2000s. I remember Baby G going in, and he was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna take this nursing class and be a nurse." And I was like, "That's cool." He's like, "Yeah, DJing's cool, man, but I just want to do something else." I really thought that was awesome. I was like, "Man, that's, you know." Because, you know, sometimes you're, like, really involved in the music industry, right? We were like, someone's all into rapping or someone all into, like, DJing all the time. You're like, sometimes you want to just, like, man, I like video games or I like something.
Right.
Like, let's go play some basketball or let's, you know, just do something different. So I like people who have, like, a different life. Like, you know, a non-just doing the same thing. So I really like when Baby G did that.
Well, that's what it looks like when it grew up, man.
You're right. All right, Noob, that's roll call number one. But who else you got?
What can you tell me about another guy? So Baby G, he did the cuts in the ring. We went to Jesus El Matador Chavez's boxing ring to shoot my first music video.
That's right.
And then there was a guy who was coordinating the dancing in that video as well as played a role. And that's Mr. Romeo Navarro. What do you know about him?
Breakdance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, God of Austin. I don't say God because there's a lot of really good people out there, but, you know, definitely a legend. Is it twice a year or just once a year now? The B-Boy City?
I believe it's once a year.
Okay. I remember they're doing it twice at one point.
I said St. David's, but Baby G is Seton.
Oh, Baby G at Seton.
Huh? Because I look online and I see where Jorge Garza, Baby G, he won some award.
At the hospital?
Yeah.
That sounds like him. He's killing the game in the DJ.
Unless the internet's just lying.
And now in
20 Seton nurses awarded prestigious Seton nursing scholarship. I mean, this was like 7 years ago, but I'm not surprised that he's one of them, you know? So Romeo, B-Boy, I would say B-Boy
guy. Now we're going back to Romeo.
Yeah, we're jumping around. Because it all goes together.
It does.
We're all doing this Bavu video.
Yes.
G's cutting, Romeo's dancing. What else you know about him?
B-Boy City, which is like, inspires so many people around the nation to come here to Austin and dance. I've seen like amazing B-Boy battles there, individual and team and all the special kind. I remember just like, because I played probably at every single bar up and down 6th Street. So mm-hmm. I just remember him coming in there and just kind of dancing.
Mm-hmm.
If you need, you know, that's what I know. What's he doing now? What's his growing up thing?
Well, Romeo Navarro, he has a son around the same age as us too.
Okay.
And thanks to Buck Raj, who he also dances with. Well, let me back up a little bit, because I got to add to the story first. Oh. So Romeo Navarro was originally South Austin and in the gang culture. Mm-hmm. He's a Filipino dude, but he grew up in South Austin, so a lot of people mistake him for Mexican. And he was into martial arts and dancing and all around hip hop. Like, he could rap a little bit. He could, you know, write a little bit. So he intentionally took on that purpose of giving kids an alternative because it worked for him. So he would go to the rec centers. He was with a sister named Dee Nice at the time for many years, and they worked together to build a lot of it back in the day. Okay. But essentially, he was that. He was a godfather to the B-boy scene here for sure.
Yeah.
And the hip-hop scene here for sure. And so, you know, shot videos. And then B-Boy City was just its own thing where a lot of DJs would come through and work, and it was really just this jam thing. And you saw how hard they would come through parties back in the day. Like, they, even if they weren't necessarily supposed to be dancing in the middle of the floor because somebody had a problem with that culture, they were gonna get down. They were gonna find a way. And so I met him in the early to mid 90s. And I was like, man, when I get a chance to make music, you're gonna be on stage with me. And we did so many huge shows together.
Yeah.
Big old shows.
They'll just pop out.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes you were DJing, you know? They'd pop out. Like when we did that Ludacris show at Stubbs.
Mm-hmm.
I know they were part of that show. And many others. Snoop Dogg shows. All kinds of stuff. Yeah, they were always presence in some of my videos. They would just wreck the whole video.
Yes. And then he like inspired so many other young people of that crew. One being Blitz, right?
Right.
Who started the DJ school in South Austin. Who
was 13 mm-hmm. when Romeo and all them were one apartment complex over from me when I was like a sophomore at UT in like 1994.
So that's how you
Blitz was a little 12, 13-year-old. No, I met him somewhere else, but mm-hmm. they would ask me to come over freestyle. Sometimes I'd be dressed like this. Like, they would bug out because I would have just got off work somewhere.
This is a collared shirt.
And they were like, this dude's freestyling in a tie. Oh, my God, and he's nice. Like, I used to bug them out. In that way, because I would always try to, basically like I'm sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
And so Blitz was super young, and now he's teaching. Your daughter, right?
Yeah, he...
crazy.
My daughter was taking his class for about a year and a half, or a year. But I was really into soccer, and then she took a break because she just wanted to take a break, and she's like, I'm going to get into dancing, and we're trying to get her into ballet or like hip-hop dance, and then we're like... Man, Blitz got this class, and mm-hmm. you know, I'm a hip hop DJ. Let's just put it in that, you know, let's just go local, let's go with someone we know. And she did amazing things, and she loved it for a long time. Doing handstands and just kind of hitting the floor. I never seen my little girl hit the floor. I was like, teary eyed hip hop dad right there. Hip hop mm-hmm. grew up all day right there. Just watching my little girl break dance, you know. I never broke dance, like, you know, but just it was just cool, you know.
We weaved another one in there without even telling you what Romeo does. Shout out to Blitz. So Romeo,
anyone who breaks,
is now with mm-hmm. the Austin Fire Department. He's a fireman.
That's some grown up stuff.
Oh man, that's dope.
We're all like, just, you know,
Austin Fire Department.
Older people, nurses, B-boy teachers, and fire department.
Mm.
Firemen.
I got more for you.
Who's
you want some more?
We can do one more.
One more.
Go.
It's a tough choice, man. Okay. Tell me when you know who I'm talking about. Go. All right. So I'm a, I don't know, sophomore, junior at UT. And when the freshmen come in, I'm mentoring them in the wrong things in many cases. You know, how to drink and party and hang out and chase girls and be silly, you know.
You're like an RA?
There was a period that I wasn't an RA, but I was whatever, like, the antithesis of an RA. It's just a, you know, a dude out there wilding out of the house. And so this one dude
I could not picture that. All right,
glad to be out of the house. Just, you know, for a couple of days. So, brother comes from Houston. He's super clean. We call him Goldie sometimes because he has a gold tooth, shiny gold tooth. Mm. Always dressed clean, nice edge up, nice cut. I don't remember what
classic H-Town dude.
Yeah, starched up. He was a classic H-Town dude, real clean dude. And I remember one time he said I was blowing his high because I was freestyling so long, because that's what I did too, you know, in that era, that college era. Just rhyme. Just found, you know, this lovely thing that I was able to do and just loved that gift at that time. Yeah. So anyway, getting on his nerves, right? Mm-hmm. And I believe, like, in West Campus,
he was rapping too.
No, not at all. Not at all. It was annoying to him. And I think he was kind of hitting licks on West Campus, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
I don't know exactly what, but you get the idea, like, hitting some licks. And ends up going to prison.
Oh.
Comes out.
UT student.
Yes.
Longhorn.
Yes.
Okay.
Gets out of prison. When I see him, he's the same dude, but he is interested in rapping now, and he's also interested in studying the Bible.
Okay.
And so he shared a story about Tower of Babel when I was working in Back Pocket, you know, height of the Hump Day era and all that, when I'm, you know, Romeo, Baby G, same time period we're talking about.
Okay.
So he's out now, and he likes to freestyle now, and he likes to rap now, and I don't know exactly what he's going to do, but he's, you know, throwing events and kind of checking out the scene and getting out there and getting to know people, and he's definitely straight edge now, for lack of a better description, right?
Yeah.
So eventually he starts getting the hang of the freestyle.
Yes.
He starts doing anything he can. Going on the radio with Jeff Ketchum, doing sports wrap-ups. Going to South by Southwest, doing South by Southwest wrap-up.
Okay.
Doing speaking gigs. Starts playing acoustic guitar, right?
Okay.
The first year, I believe, that I became a teacher, he's a felon, right? Mm-hmm. He does a keynote speech for my school district. And when he first put out a project that I knew was real serious, was actually before that. He went from the prison tower back to the UT tower, ends up graduating with a 4.0. So he made this documentary called Tower to Tower.
Okay.
So this is a guy I've known for like 25 years.
Wow.
What's his name?
Saul Paul.
Saul Paul. The newest member of the Yak podcast crew.
Yak!
Welcome, Saul Paul.
What's up, Saul Paul?
So what do you know about Saul Paul? What was your... wasn't your perspective on him,
The first time I met him was like inspirational... musician that comes at community events like school things or rallies and you know, does positive and music with young people and kind of uplifts the community. That's all I knew him. I didn't know all that stuff you knew. I didn't know he was called Goldie and like was from H-Town. Like, great performer.
Oh yeah.
Made the, you know, it, you know, and he does a good job and gets his money and like
all over the country.
Loves seeing people successful like that, for sure, man.
Volunteers a lot of his time, takes care of his business and business with his wife. Incredible guy, Saul Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So it grew up.
It grew up. And then all that stuff makes sense, what you're talking about. All right, man. Well, this was a great, great conversation. We'll see you guys next time.
Peace.